It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson's here, and of course, the topic of the day, the WannaCry ransomware exploit. How did it work? Why did it happen? Who's at fault? Who not to blame? It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 612, recorded May 16th, 2017. Makes you want to cry. Security Now is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/securitynow. And literally by Sonic, Twit's 10 gigabit fiber internet service provider. Join Sonic's internet revolution as they bring fast, affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Visit sonic.com/twit to sign up for service and receive your first month free. And by IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy and safety online. And never in our nation's great history has there been a greater need for a man like Steve Gibson, a man who can save us. Steve, the host of the show, welcome. It's good to see you.
Well, all of our listeners knew what today's topic would be. So I had some fun with the title. So this week's Security Now, number 612, titled Makes You Wanna Cry.
I felt so guilty because I got sick, as you know, and I missed doing the radio show. And I think of all the shows to miss, this was the worst show I could have missed all year long. On the other hand, the good news is there'll be more of the same soon. So
there will, and you can sort of, you know, the more is known about it now.
Well,
so you
can
do a really comprehensive wrap up for on this coming weekend.
Well, I'm going to listen carefully what you have to say.
So, and the other blessing is that because there's a lot of interesting things to talk about WannaCry, is that it so dominated the rest of, I mean, like the entire week, that we don't have the normal 16 different topics that we also need to talk about. So we have a reasonable amount of week's news. We're going to talk about...
The hacking community was just all sitting back in awe.
Just like stunned.
Watching.
Exactly. They're all running around, you know, focused on a single thing rather than up to their regular mischief. We have an update, sort of a follow-up on the FCC's net neutrality commenting system. The discovery of an active keystroke logger present on dozens of different HP computer models.
That just shocked me. I'm really curious.
Just
about
sloppiness.
That.
Yeah. I'm sure it wasn't malicious, but that doesn't mean it isn't a problem. We've got an interesting continuing movement that I call the loss of web browser platform. Heterogeneity that I want to talk about. The our gang over at the OSTIF who've been funding the review and auditing of open source software, who previously did Veracrypt, just finished their audit or funding and working with the audit of OpenVPN and found one bad problem and some other things to get cleaned up. So we'll talk about that. More on the dangers of using smartphones as authentication tokens, which has been a recurring theme for us recently. Some very welcome news finally on the Android security front, coming with Android O later this summer. We'll talk about how there's going to be a deep re-architecting that actually is underway and already present in the developer preview that should significantly improve Android's ability to stay current with patches, even for non-Pixel and Google and Nexus devices. And some long-awaited and much overdue updated password recommendations from the NIST. And the number one on the list is just a kick, because this is the advice we've been giving for so long that ran contrary to the formal advice. Well, they finally figured that out too. We've got a little bit of follow-up errata, a bit of tech humor, and some miscellany, some closing the loop with our listeners, and then we're going to get into everything that is known about WannaCry, from how it happened, what it is, some technical details, a little bit of Microsoft CYA from Brad Smith, the president and chief legal guy there, and that'll bring us current. So I think another great podcast.
I'd love to talk to you about Brad Smith's piece, because I do agree with him about some things.
I do, too.
I'm not sure, Microsoft is free from blame here. But
yes, he disavowed any responsibility.
Yeah,
it's like,
But at the same time, there's no such thing as perfect software, and everybody.
Well, and what does it mean, then, that they updated XP? I mean,
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, they said never again, but there's so many XP machines out there. I think that was them being a good corporate citizen. But again, it's your take that matters, because this is Security Now with Steve Gibson, not some guy named Leo. I do want to say, though, that our show today is sponsored by a very fine company called Quicken Loans. You've heard of them, no doubt. They're the number two lender in the country, $92 billion in mortgage loans last year. That's just for several reasons, but one of them is they're really the best. They're certainly, according to J.D. Power, a number one in customer satisfaction for the last 7 years for mortgage origination, number one in mortgage servicing for the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, that tells you something. They're really good. I like them. Well, I like their spirit and their style. I like what they're doing for the downtown Detroit. They're a good company. And if you're going to get a home loan, you want to get it from a good company, a company you can trust, but also a company that makes the process transparent and easy for you. And that's what's so great about Rocket Mortgage. They've done something for us geeks that I really appreciate. Now, I have a lot of experience. You know, since we moved to Petaluma, we've moved 4 times. That's 4 different home loans. 4 different days, weeks, and months of horror. The last time, 3 years ago, it took more than a month to get a loan. But I can tell you from now on, it's Rocket Mortgage. Whether you're buying or refinancing, it's entirely online. And that means it's a lot faster. You can do everything you need to do online on your phone, on your tablet, on your computer. That even includes the paperwork you need to submit, like bank statements, or pay stubs or whatever. Just with a touch of a button, you can set the term of the loan, how long it is. You can set the rate. They give you some choices there. Customize it. You can do this all on your phone and then say go and get approved, not in a month, not even in weeks or days, but in minutes. Minutes! Which means you could apply at an open house and say, we'd like to make an offer. Here's our loan approval right there. That is empowering for home buyers. I love this product, mainly because they designed it for us, for geeks. It's called Rocket Mortgage because it lifts the burden of getting a home loan. It's fast. It's modern. Whether you're looking to buy or refi, you got to skip the bank. You got to skip the waiting and go completely online. QuickenLoans.com/security now. We do that Security Now thing so they know you heard it on Steve's show, so it's great. It's great if you use that. That helps us a lot. QuickenLoans.com/security now. Rocket Mortgage, an equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. Rocket Mortgage. Love them. QuickenLoans.com/, and don't forget this part, security now, all one word. All right, back we go to Steve Areno.
I have to put my spinner down so I can focus.
Oh, now. Are you a fidgeter? Now, you sent me, and I don't have it because my 14-year-old stole it. That is the best spinner I've ever seen. It's called the iSpin.
The iSpin. Amazon does have them.
It's made of entirely of brass. It's machined. Yep. It does have bearings, I know, because I took it apart.
Yeah, you're able to unscrew the hub and sort of see them. And he actually recommends you do that because you don't want to ever put any lubrication in it because that would the viscosity would slow it down.
Right.
But if you want to just blow it out, if it collects any dust over time.
Anyway, you sent me one, and I am grateful. And one of the things that's cool, and I think I've demonstrated this already, you can remove an arm, and then it's unweighted. And it's a great way to learn physics. I told Michael, I said, try this and then tell me. Come back. You can use it, but you have to tell me why that works.
Yep. And I was playing with it again last night. I have a desk lamp, which is LED and dimmable. If you dim an LED lamp, normally what they're doing is they're reducing the duty cycle of the on time. So it creates a shorter burst, much more like a strobe. And spinning it under a dimmed LED light is really fun because it does like the stop motion thing. And as it's slowing down, the interaction of the spin versus the flicker creates phased beating effects. So yeah. Anyway, as I said to you before the show, I have an idea that I'll steal some time on the weekend and experiment because I think I have a fun upgrade for this. So
these things have just spread like topsy through the schools to the point where schools are actually sending people
home.
They
banned them.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So our picture of the week, I got a kick out of, and it's apropos of today's topic. It's the classic Venn diagram that we all learned and is a very useful means of showing the amount of the sort of the nature of sets. It's used in set theory for you'd have two different groups that have some things in common. Well, in this Venn diagram, we've got two, it's so-called the disjoint set, meaning, or the null set, where there are two separate regions with no overlap. The one on the left labeled people who use, and the title is The Flaw in the WannaCry Extortion Scheme. And the flaw is that there is no overlap between these two sets. The first one being people who use Windows XP and people tech savvy enough to figure out how to pay ransom with a Bitcoin. And of course, so you could have people infected who can't pay if they want to, because that's like, what? What's a Bitcoin? And then you've got all the Bitcoin people who are like, I'm not, I would never be using XP anymore. Are you crazy? And it is an interesting aspect of this last week and WannaCry that as extensive and, you know, as huge a cyber event as it has been, the last number I saw was like $53,000 in equivalent Bitcoin payments.
Yeah, so, Brian Krebs says that he wrote a book called Spam Nation where he talks about this, that's not unusual, that these guys don't really care. If they make 50 grand, they're very happy. Yeah. Some guy in Moldova who, you know, is unemployed and they don't really care that it's the consequence of to billions of, you know, dollars worth of consequences because they got their 50 grand.
Right. And
although the latest news makes me think there's more to it, but go ahead.
Well, the backup for that idea also is that previous malware didn't make anybody any money.
Right.
You know, very much like the Gmail phishing scheme that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, it didn't do anything bad to you. It was just sort of a proof of concept. It's like, oh, I'm just going to propagate because I can. So this would have happened even if it didn't have the ransomware back end,
right.
Just because you could, like all of like MS Blast and Code Red and NIMDA and concept. You know, all of these previous internet worms. Yeah. So the fact that it made money was just sort of a bonus. And of course, but the fact that it encrypted people's system, I mean, like all the important files on their system, and brought huge chunks of IT infrastructure to its knees, you know, made it much more devastating than if it had just been a worm propagating for the worm's sake. Anyway, we'll get to that in a second.
I guess the point is that depending on who created it, the devastation may indeed have been the goal.
Oh, interesting.
Maybe you haven't heard the latest.
I haven't heard the latest.
Right, I'll fill you in when we get to it.
So definitely come back when we get there. The FCC is acting a little oddly. They're reporting spamming of the FCC net neutrality commenting site, and they claimed DDoS attacks. And you know, the moment I heard that, I remembered that my own experience, and it might have, I don't think I did it that night, but it was like sometime later the following day, the site is just horrifically designed. I don't know what the database backend is, but as I mentioned on the show last week, when I talked about the gofcyourself.com, which was the referral domain that John Oliver gave us on HBO's last week tonight with John Oliver, Sunday before last, was that, you know, you couldn't get a total of the number of comments. It was just very clunky in its design. So my suspicion was that it was just lots of people trying to submit comments, that it wasn't a classic DDoS attack.
And there was spamming happening from the anti-net neutrality side.
Yes.
They were all duplicate comments.
Correct. So it wasn't even very well done, spamming. And I did note also that their site doesn't have any bot protection on it. So it was like, okay, again, another strike against it. Who's going to do a good form submission that doesn't prevent it from being spammed?
It's a government website.
Well,
what do you expect?
The government, exactly.
But by the way, the same thing happened last time. The difference was that the chairman of the FCC didn't declare that they'd been DDoSed and closed the whole thing down.
Right. Yeah. A guy named John Bambinek, a threat intelligence manager at Fidelis Cybersecurity, was quoted saying, "There don't appear to be any indications of a DDoS attack in the sensors we use to monitor for such things. It appears the issue with the FCC is less of a DDoS attack as traditionally defined and more of an issue of crowdsourcing comments generated by John Oliver and Reddit," who also picked up on it. And, of course, we did on this podcast on the following Tuesday, which was last week. Also, Jake Williams, a CEO of cybersecurity firm Rendition InfoSec, said the FCC, quote, "offered no support to prove a DDoS had occurred," adding, "there was no observed dark web chatter about such a DDoS before or after the event, and no botnets that we're monitoring," he said, "received any commands ordering a DDoS on the FCC's site." And also, when the press asked for additional background from the FCC on the so-called DDoS attacks, no response was forthcoming. So I think they were, unfortunately, just probably embarrassed by the amount of both legitimate and illegitimate traffic that came to there in order to lodge their protest. This was much tweeted from our listeners, the news that the HP Connexent audio driver was found to be logging keystrokes. As ours put it, quote, "HP is selling more than two dozen models of laptops and tablets that covertly monitor every keystroke a user makes. The devices then store the key presses in an unencrypted file on the hard drive." So in looking at this, And I mean, and several of the characteristics of this argue that it was not deliberate, that it's just highly irresponsible keystroke logging with permanent stroke-by-stroke persistent storage that has been in place for apparently maybe as much as 2 years or more than 2 years. The driver, which is digitally signed by Conexant, who is a legitimate audio chip maker that HP uses in many of their machines, was digitally signed on the day before Christmas, December 24th of 2015. So more than 2 years ago. The security firm that first spotted this, Mod Zero, disclosed this information, noting that version 1.0.0.31 was then later extended with even more problematic functions. The most recent version is 1.0.0.46, which implements the logging of all keystrokes, they wrote, into the publicly for any user readable file. It's at /users/public/mictray, mictray.log. So any users of HP machines ought to, if you're curious, go look at /users/public/mictray.log. To see if your passwords are all present there. Now here's why several things suggest that this was not deliberate or malicious. For example, the file is not appended to after each login; it is overwritten. So it feels like some forensics and developer code that was there for development was left in. And these guys wrote, you know, so like trying to make it seem as bad as possible because they're the security firm who found it, so they want to have found something big. They wrote, if you regularly make incremental backups of your hard drive, whether to the cloud or to an external hard drive, a history of all keystrokes for the last few years could probably be found in your backups. Okay, well, yes, because, you know, that's how you would extend the badness from the fact that this is overwriting that file with each login rather than deliberately continuing to persist them over time. They wrote that the keylogger is included in a device driver developed by Conexant, a manufacturer of audio chips that are included in the vulnerable HP devices. They said this type of debugging turns the audio driver effectively into key logging spyware. On the basis of meta information of the files, this key logger, they wrote, has already existed on HP computers since at least Christmas 2015, as I had said. So what can we do? There is a program, this Mictray, either Mictray, M-I-C-T-R-A-Y, 32 or 64.exe, which exists in the Windows System 32 directory. So they suggest deleting or renaming the executable so that no keystrokes are recorded anymore. You will lose some functionality. The reason an audio driver has any business with the keyboard, I should explain, is that it listens to keystrokes globally within the system in order to implement hotkeys. So this Conexant driver supports various hotkeys for, like, you know, muting the audio or turning it up and turning it down. And so this was probably put in there for that reason, for diagnostics and debugging, but then just left on by mistake. Now, this is one of those things which probably in itself wasn't malicious. It isn't sending them anywhere. It isn't phoning home. It isn't doing any of the things it could be doing. But it's also become much more worrisome now that it is widely known and has been publicly disclosed, such that if anything nasty gets into an HP machine, it would almost be malpractice on the malware's part not to go check to see if it can snark, you know, suck up all the keystrokes which have been logged since you logged in. So it's worth taking some action. I imagine that HP will quickly get an update from Conexant and push that out, make updates available. So it's worth, you know, depending on your profile, who you are, what you probably could do would be to replace the log file with an empty text file, rename it, and then set it to be read-only. That's a simple prophylactic measure. If you create a file that it wants to create and set it and make it empty and then set it to read-only, most software is not smart enough to look for that, change it to writable, and then delete it and then start writing to it. So my guess, and you could easily just tell, you know, you could see whether the scheme, the simple strategy works. If so, that'll keep it from logging anything because it just won't be able to until you get yourself an update that no longer tries to do that at all. But this is an interesting opportunity because, and this ties into something we'll be talking about in a few minutes, and that is to note that the Windows platform has never been secure. It predates a worry that we have today about security or a consciousness, an awareness of security. For example, the fact that debuggers have the ability to attach themselves to any other process is both convenient for developers and horrific for security. You know, when we talk about DLL injection, that's something that you can do. You can just inject a DLL into some other program's operating process space and cause it to run. So now you're running your code or that DLL code in the context of another process, which the process probably doesn't want to have happen. But Windows is like, oh, well, you know. Think of the flexibility. It's like, And, you know, this goes back to my original, you know, Windows metafile observation, where I didn't think it was malicious that Microsoft allowed a Windows metafile to contain native code, which a metafile tag allowed you to jump to. It made total sense to me that back then some developer thought, well, if we need some function that we didn't build into the metafile interpreter, let's just let it run natively. And everyone thought I was crazy for thinking that. It's like, no, you just don't understand the world in which all this happened. So similarly, Windows apps can freely establish what are known as global hooks for many different things. You can hook the mouse. You can hook the keyboard. You can hook screen events. And, you know, this allows the kind of flexibility that we're used to having in Windows, where you can have macro programs that are able to record keystrokes and inject the keystrokes into applications for macro playback. Whoa, isn't that handy? Well, yes. And you can also get up to all kinds of mischief doing the same thing. And various of the Windows assistive features are, you know, depend upon those sorts of things. So, and of course, we know that programs can capture the screen, which you may not want them to do if it happens to have sensitive content on it at the moment. So Windows traditionally has been very developer friendly and a power users environment. And of course, this is part of what Microsoft plans to be changing with Windows S, which implements, among other things, a highly restrictive application sandboxing so that all of these sorts of things, which have historically been possible on the Windows platform, will be lost under Windows S. And so there will be a definite trade-off between the power user functionality and flexibility we're used to, and Windows S, which will be implementing a next generation API with applications that you can only run if you get them from the Windows Store, and everything that that brings with it. So it's kind of like, you know, the closed environments that we see, for example, with Apple and the iOS environment, where, yes, you do get better security in trade, well, in trade for and losing a lot of the freedom and flexibility that can be convenient and handy. And this brings me into the next topic, which I called "We're Losing Browser Heterogeneity." Bleeping Computer had a nice post. I spent some time there because they also had a lot of coverage about the all of the WannaCry stuff. But I liked their coverage of this. They wrote a one-liner in the Windows Store policy is the reason why we'll never have the original Chrome, Firefox, Opera, or other browsers available through the official Windows Store. Included in the security section of the Windows Store policy is the line. This line is specifically addressed at browsers and reads the following. They wrote, quote, from Microsoft, apps that browse the web must use the appropriate HTML and JavaScript engines provided by the Windows platform. And that's not just any Windows platform. That's the new universal Windows platform API applications. So the Bleeping Computer goes on to say, this means that every browser currently listed on the Windows Store is nothing more than an offshoot of Microsoft's Edge HTML and the HTML and JavaScript engines found in Edge. And then Bleeping Computer notes, Apple and Google have similar policies. So this is not, you know, just something Microsoft is doing, and I don't mean to paint it as that. That's why this is bigger than that. This is what we're seeing is this loss of browser choice in platforms moving forward. Bleeping Computer says the policy is similar to what Apple has done with iOS, the company forcing apps to use its web rendering engine to process web content. Google took a harder stance with Chrome OS and forbade other browsers altogether. In both cases, the company cited security concerns as their engineers have worked to secure their operating system around those web rendering engines. In the case of the Windows Store, they write, this revelation came to light after the launch of Windows 10S, a tethered version, as they described it, of Windows 10, that will only allow the installation of Windows Store apps. As users kept asking, when will Google and Firefox port their browsers to the Windows Store so that they could use them in Windows 10S? The question was finally answered last week when a developer tried to convert his Chromium-based browser to and .apx version compatible with Windows Store distribution. The Windows Store crew specifically told the developer that they cannot approve his browser because of the aforementioned policy that mandates that all apps that access the internet use the approved HTML and JS rendering engines, JavaScript rendering engines. The developer shared his experience and official communications with a ZDNet journalist. So, Microsoft's policy effectively bans standalone third-party browsers. While some were hoping to see Chrome or Firefox available on the Windows Store as UWP. That's the Universal Windows Platform, the next generation API that replaces the earlier Win32 and .NET platforms. This may never be possible, as this would mean that Google, Firefox, and other vendors would need to rewrite their browsers from scratch to use Microsoft's Edge HTML. And they say this will never happen unless Windows 10S becomes a huge success and browser vendors see a benefit to port their browsers. In this case, we won't see UWP versions of the original Chrome and Firefox engines, but only so-called bastard browsers, as Bleeping Computer describes them, like we have on iOS. For example, you can't call Firefox for iOS a true Firefox browser. It's just an older version of the WebKit engine with a Firefox UI lookalike on top, and lacking many of Firefox's original features. The conclusion is that Microsoft has effectively banned any self-standing third-party browser from the Windows Store. Additionally, Windows 10S users better get used to using Edge or any of the other, and here again they say, bastard browsers that use Edge's repackaged core. And, you know, I'm a fan of Edge. It's as we've talked about on this podcast, it is a beautifully re-implemented from scratch. You know, they scrapped IE and they started over, and they did a whole lot of things very right. I mean, it's a beautiful piece of technology. So I don't mean to disparage it in any way. It just means that if you're going to go Windows 10S, Edge will be your browser, which is not a bad thing. But it also means your browser can't be actual Firefox or Chrome. That will no longer be an option. And of course, we also know that you no longer have a choice in search providers. If you go 10S, Bing is your search engine, and that cannot be changed. And finally, the article ends saying the original Chrome and Firefox browsers, as what we have today, built around their own native engines, will remain accessible to Windows 10 users via standalone installers only. But again, 10S will refuse them. So I thought this was interesting because this, you know, browsers are now the way we connect to the internet. We've noticed that they are also the primary point of attack. They're the way bad things get into our systems and into networks, much more so today than it used to be when it was something quaint like email macros, which, you know, or flash exploits. Now it's the browser. And so it makes sense from Microsoft's standpoint. If they're determined to make Windows secure, then the things that the freedom and the flexibility that we have, that Windows has historically enjoyed, that will be lost. Windows 10S will be a choice, and I guess I did see somewhere. I'm sure you're more up to speed on this than I am, Leo, because I have not looked at it. As I understand it, 10S users can't have an opportunity to move to Windows 10 Pro, like for the rest of the year or something.
If you buy Microsoft hardware, yes. So if you buy the new Microsoft laptop, which comes with 10S, and that's the only Microsoft device that does, you get a free upgrade through the rest of the year. And that's the only way they could get people to buy it, because nobody knows if 10S will do.
Right, right. It might be another Windows phone.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Now would be a great time to take a break, since I just took a sip of coffee and I could go with another one.
Well, you did wake me up. You might as well use me for something. My God. All right. Well, let me tell
you. Thank you, Steve. And now I'm going to take over.
This is a chance for me to talk about company that literally brings this show to you.
So many of our listeners.
I know. Do they write to you saying, I can't get it?
Why
do you do an ad for a product I want, but I can't get it? Well, I'm sorry. I thought about that, and I thought, well, the thing is, nowadays it's good to know that it is possible to be a successful ISP and not violate your customers' privacy, not give government information, or at least fight it when the government asks for information.
And when you're considering your next move, may be wanting to move.
There are some geeks who literally pick where they live, and I'm one of them, based on internet connectivity. And Sonic is the best. They provide our internet here at the studios. And by the way, they provide our 10 gigabit internet. And that's probably what's getting people really angry, is they want 10 gigabit. That is not a product for most people. That's a fairly expensive business product. But it is available. I mean, I can't deny that you could do it if you want. But let me tell you a little bit about Sonic's residential product, because I think for the price, you might find this the best deal of all. It's pretty remarkable. So Sonic gives you, with their residential internet, unlimited and uncapped internet. They don't limit it. They offer fiber to the premises, but not everywhere. And this is where people get angry. San Francisco, the North Bay Area, and the East Bay Area. But I think if you visit sonic.com and say, hey, why aren't you in my area? You know, the more they hear from other areas, the more likely those areas will be, you know, provided by Sonic. Here's what you get, though, and this is the thing I know everybody loves. You get 15 email accounts. You get a gigabyte of storage. You get a personal web hosting with a new domain of your choice, a fax line service. You get a gigabit down. But wait, there's more. You get a home phone connection, a true home phone connection with unlimited local and long-distance dialing. You can keep your existing number ported over. And this whole thing that I just described, everything, $40 a month. Gigabit internet plus all of that, $40 a month. And I think this is really why I like doing this ad and why we do the ad even though most of you can't get it. It's possible. And so don't let those other internet service providers say, oh, we couldn't possibly do it for that price. It's possible. I've heard internet service providers say, oh, nobody wants gigabit internet. Yes, they do. Yes, we do. Stand up for privacy, friendly and local customer support, uncapped bandwidth, and affordable pricing for all products. I feel like I'm giving a stump speech. Sonic's customer advocacy is paving the way for a better state of internet access in America. I love Sonic, and I am... You know, I come in here because we get such great bandwidth. No one machine can go greater than a gigabit, by the way. We don't have like 10 gigabit interfaces in our machines. But having 10 gigabits means nobody's waiting for internet access ever. It's just fantastic. And we've been here how long? It's never been down, never been slow, always been great. Join the internet revolution. If you're lucky enough to live in a Sonic area, you will never regret becoming a Sonic customer. Go to sonic.com/twit. You get your first month of Sonic internet and phone service free. Plus, you bundle it with Dish, you'll save $120 on your Sonic bill. I'm sorry to those of you who can't get it. I truly am. And I'm in your boat because I can't get Sonic fiber where I live. I can get Sonic DSL, but I can't get Sonic fiber. And it's like, come on, Sonic, just a little farther, just a little bit farther. Sonic.
We're not sorry for you, Leo.
I know. Sonic. I just come to work when I want to download Linux or, you know, with really big files. Sonic.com/twit. And seriously, Dane Jasper, and you know I've interviewed him. We've had him on Triangulation. Everybody at Sonic, they're just the best. They're quality people. And they really are showing you that it's possible. And that's what I really like.
That's a good point.
Yep. Yep.
So our friends at the OSTIF.
Oh, them.
Working with Quarks Lab. They're the guys that have been financing a number of these open source audits to everyone's benefit.
Good.
OSTIF.org. And they just finished. Actually, I know of this because they sent me a tweet. They sent a tweet saying, Steve, you did excellent coverage of our VeraCrypt audit on Security Now. We just published our OpenVPN results. And the results were very worthwhile. The audit was worthwhile, and it did drive a version change and update and fix from OpenVPN. I just checked the log on a free BSD machine, and it doesn't yet know about 2.4.0, which is now the latest and what anyone using OpenVPN should go to. It's not a massive problem. I mean, there was one vulnerability rated critical slash high. So, you know, worth doing. But if your OS, your OS will probably need to wait for a build for it of OpenVPN, and 2.4 is what you want. I think one of my machines is 2.3.13 or something. So they audited
2.41. Is that
2.4 point anything would be good.
Good. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you, H.
Yes. So they audited OpenVPN and the Endis 6 tap driver, the Windows GUI, and the Linux versions. And I was wrong. They audited 2.4.0, and what was updated was 2.4.2.
Oh,
so you do need a dot increase to 0.2.
Checking my updates right now.
So the auditors wrote, the public disclosure of these vulnerabilities coincides with the release of OpenVPN 2.4.2, which fixes all of the high priority concerns. OpenVPN, they wrote, is much safer with these audits, and the fixes applied to the OpenVPN mean that the world is safer when using this software. They wrote, we have verified that the OpenVPN software, and this is important, is generally well written with strong adherence to security practices. And you want that, because even an auditor can miss something, but it's worth taking some comfort in the just the general conduct of the people who wrote this over time, that they kept their eye on the ball, they didn't get sloppy, and that there was a lot of attention and focus put on kept on the security aspect. I do have a link here. You can just go to ostif.org to find it, but I also got a link in the show notes to the whole report that goes into greater detail. But it was one critical high vulnerability fixed, and one medium vulnerability, and then five low or informational vulnerabilities and concerns. So again, as we've said, it's great to have the source open, but it only is useful if somebody who didn't write it reads it. And these guys did. So again, thanks to the OSTIF for pulling together the funds to finance people who are security aware, looking at the source code. There's a Bitcoin exchange. They believe that they're among the biggest, if not the, named Kraken, who describe themselves as a San Francisco-based world's largest Bitcoin exchange in euro volume and liquidity. They write of themselves, Kraken's clients also trade U.S. dollars, Canadian dollars, British pounds, Japanese yen, and other digital currencies on a platform consistently rated the best and most secure Bitcoin exchange by independent news media. They said, founded 6 years ago in 2011, Kraken was the first Bitcoin exchange to have its market data displayed on the Bloomberg terminal, the first to pass a cryptographically verifiable proof of reserves audit, a partner in the first cryptocurrency bank, and one of the first exchanges to offer leveraged Bitcoin margin trading. Oh, wonderful. Kraken is trusted by hundreds of thousands of traders, institutions, and authorities across the world, they write, from Tokyo's court-appointed trustee to Germany's BaFin-regulated Fidor Bank. And finally, Kraken is backed by investors including Hummingbird Ventures. Oh, those are real guys. Blockchain Capital and Barry Silbert's Digital Currency Group, among others. I say all that to preface their interesting comments about using and rethinking the security of phones, smartphones specifically, as authentication tokens. They wrote, "Heed this or perish." They say, "Let's begin with the assumption," which is a little specious, but still it's, you know, that's what they want us to assume, "that within 24 hours, your usual mobile phone number will be hijacked by social engineers." As I said, okay, well, maybe for some people. "They will use your number to gain access to every," but this, certainly this is possible if it happened. "They will use your number to gain access to every account you own that utilizes phone-based authentication and account recovery, such as your email. They will then use that access to inform that access and information to compromise more accounts and harass, steal, blackmail, and extort you and your associates. In the past month," they write, "there have been at least 10 cases of people publicly involved in the cryptocurrency scene being victimized by mobile phone hijacking." Okay, so targeted attacks. "The consequences have been expensive, embarrassing, enduring, and in one case, life-threatening. If you are in any way publicly involved in cryptocurrency, consider yourself an active target. You need to immediately audit the security of your accounts, especially email, social media, social networking, and mobile phone." Somehow, they write, "the masses have been led to believe," yes, well, and we know how, "that phone makers are inextricably bound to, that phone numbers are inextricably bound to identities, and therefore make good authentication tools." Of course, we on the podcast, have, as we've been covering recently, know otherwise. They say there's a reason that Kraken has never supported SMS-based authentication. "The painful reality is that your telco operates at the security level," and I got a kick out of this, "of a third-rate coat check clerk." Here's an example.
Where can you find a coat check clerk these days?
Yeah. Here's an example interaction. Hacker: "Can I have my jacket?" Telco: "Sure. Can I have your ticket?" Hacker: I lost it." Telco: "Well, do you remember the number?" Hacker: No, but it's that one right over there."
Oh, boy.
Telco: "Okay, cool. Here you go. Please rate us 10 out of 10 on the survey." Yeah. And I won't go on. The article goes on for anyone who's interested. But I appreciated that. I thought, first of all, it was interesting that the known weakness in smartphone authentication via SMS, as we've discussed, is now being used increasingly in targeted attacks. For people who are not prone to being targeted, you know, you shouldn't run around with your tinfoil hat on and, you know, the sky's not falling. But given a choice, you absolutely want time-based authentication, not an SMS message per instance. And if you can disable SMS in favor of anything else for account recovery, that would be good. Because it is, remember that typically SMS is hopefully only an additional factor. Somebody first has to have your username and your password, and then also another second factor beyond knowing your password. The problem is it's often used for account recovery. "I forgot my password." "Oh, well, we'll send you a blurb to your phone number in order to recover it." Well, that's the huge Achilles heel in where we are today is account recovery. And it's funny. I mean, in anticipation of this, Squirrel already incorporates a facility for preventing that. Once a user becomes familiar with Squirrel and realizes and understands how it works and gets it, they're able to set a sticky switch in Squirrel that asks the sites they visit to please preemptively disable any non-Squirrel account recovery. Because again, if you leave that there, then that's still a glaring hole in your authentication. So this essentially, it's sort of a beacon that your use of Squirrel broadcasts as you use it, which you would only turn on once you understand how it works and you're comfortable with it. So it's not on by default. But once you want to, as you visit sites again with Squirrel, it makes a sticky setting at the site saying, decline anything but my subsequent use of Squirrel. So again, lots of nice little tidbits that have always been there. And the good news for Android, speaking of happy tidbits, this is from the Android developers blog. They wrote on the Android team, and I've paraphrased this down for the podcast, but I'll say it in their voice. We view each dessert release as an opportunity to make Android better for our users and our ecosystem partners. One thing we've constantly heard from our device maker partners and, from this podcast, is that updating existing devices to a new version of Android is incredibly time-consuming and costly. And as we know, leaving IPv4 is time-consuming and costly. So if you don't do it unless you have to. Leaving SHA-1, same thing. I'd rather not. So they write, with Android O, we've been working very closely with device makers and silicon manufacturers to take steps towards solving this problem. And we're excited to give you a sneak peek at Project Treble.
Ooh.
The biggest change to the low-level, thank you, Leo, the low-level system architecture.
I did it wrong.
The crowd goes wild. The biggest change to the low-level system architecture of Android ever.
I'm getting ready for tomorrow's keynote at the Google I/O conference.
Good. Oh, and you're going to be there, aren't you?
Yeah. And this is one of the announcements from it, I'm sure.
The traditional, cumbersome, and time-consuming update and patch flow has been this. First, the Android team publishes the open source code for the latest release to the world. The silicon manufacturers, the companies that make the chips that power Android devices, must then modify that new release for their specific hardware. Next, the silicon manufacturers pass the modified new release to device makers, the companies that design and manufacture the Android devices. The device makers then modify that new release again as needed to customize it for their devices. The device makers work with the carriers to test and certify the new release. And finally, the device makers and or the carriers make the new release available to users. So is it any surprise that we're still using IPv4 and that most Android devices are way behind? It's just that process is so clunky that it just doesn't happen. Project Treble, they write, re-architects Android to make it faster, easier, and less costly for manufacturers to update devices to the new version of Android. Android has been a fabulous success, patting themselves on the back. And it's true, in the marketplace, because it presented and rigorously enforced through its compatibility test suite, known as CTS, its application layer API. And now, again, we understand because we've discussed it often in terms of the architecture of modern computer design. You know, what the reason that Windows was able to succeed as it did is that the Windows API allowed applications to be written to the API. And as long as future and succeeding versions of Windows maintained that API layer consistency, they could change the plumbing underneath and apps were compatible. That's how Windows got its backwards compatibility. So what Android did with this compatibility test suite was to implement it's a million different tests that validate and verify the consistency of that crucial interaction between applications and the Android OS and everything that is not the application. Project Treble, they write, will be doing for the Android OS framework, that is the underplumbing. Oh, I like that term. What CTS did for apps. The core concept is to separate the vendor's implementation, the device-specific lower-level software written in large part by the silicon manufacturers, from the Android OS framework. In other words, they're going to create another API layer, another interface layer, way down in the OS, which will be similarly rigorously enforced. They write, this is achieved by introducing a new vendor interface between the Android OS framework and the vendor implementation layer. The new vendor interface will be validated by a vendor test suite, VTS, analogous to the CTS, which was the compatibility test suite at the application layer, to ensure forward compatibility of the vendor implementation. Or the other way to look at it is backward compatibility. As Android is updated and patched, those will no longer need any vendor involvement. They write, once a stable vendor interface has been defined to provide access to the hardware-specific parts of Android, device makers can deliver new Android releases and updates to consumers only by updating the Android OS framework without any additional work required from the silicon manufacturers. So, you know, the silicon manufacturers, they don't want any of this. They just want to pump out silicon. So they've been forced to become software developers to support their silicon. And unfortunately, they're always the starting point for the percolation of updates. It's got to go to them first, and then it moves back up the system, finally, maybe eventually getting to the user. So they say the underlying silicon manufacturers will not need to be constantly bothered and bombarded with updates, which require their constant attention and involvement. This will all appear in Android O, and the new Project Treble architecture is already up and running on the developer preview of O for the Pixel phones. And O is slated for formal launch later this summer. And we'll find out more about it on tomorrow's Google presentation.
I think so.
Neat. Oh, I bet for sure. That's big news. I'm delighted. I mean, we talk about the troubles that Android has, and we've been saying that, you know, at this point, really the only recourse a really truly security conscious person has is to stick with one of the very major players that are demonstrating that they are right on really up to speed on keeping the phones current. Though it's late, I think it's exactly what Google had to do in order to fix this problem with Android.
This is kind of like a Ring Zero kind of a thing. Like,
bravo, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you have to be
essentially
privileged.
Yeah. Well, I would say it adds another layer. At this point, Android only had two layers. It had the application layer and everything else.
Ah.
So there was one border definition, which was the application API. What Google has done is they've added another layer. Microsoft did this. That's the HAL, the hardware abstraction layer in NT. It never really got used. Well, it did for a while because there was that funky MIPS support. Remember that NT used to there was a MIPS support, and I want to say ARM, but maybe that was pre-ARM.
Oh no, there was ARM, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, there were a few other hardware architectures. So Microsoft's original NT, that whole redesign, the HAL, the hardware abstraction layer, what meant to allow the NTOS to run on very different hardware again, what does abstraction mean? It means you create a virtual hardware definition. The software talks to that, and the hardware beneath it emulates that hardware definition. So that's what Android O does. It creates another sort of a slice, a cut point through the OS where everything hardware is below, and the hardware that only has to meet the interface spec at that layer, and then Android OS only needs to talk to the interface spec. So nice piece of work. And, you know, there is always a performance hit. Whenever you abstract and create a definition, what that actually is an interpretation. It's an interpreter. And we know that those are never as fast as native. So it may well be that 10 years ago, Android launched in 07. So that 10 years ago, they couldn't afford the hit. They just, they needed every bit of performance that they could get. And so they couldn't do another interpretation layer down in the OS. They had to go full speed. Now chips have become so much more powerful with ridiculous numbers of cores in a smartphone that they say, yeah, now we can afford an interface layer for the hardware, and we're not going to feel it because the hardware has gotten fast enough to mask any interpretation overhead that might be introduced. So, bravo.
Hey, yay. That's good.
And speaking of bravo, check this out. The NIST, what does that stand for? National Institute for Standards
and Time.
Yes, thank you. Has updated their formal recommendations, removing, among other things, periodic password change requirements. Gone.
Yay, yay, yay.
I know.
Yay.
How many times have we said, that makes no sense. Do not make people change their passwords. And so many corporate listeners of ours say, yeah, my company makes me change my password every month. And then we talked about all the workarounds, like sometimes you can't change the one you had before.
Those are really crazy.
Yeah. People have like probed the system and realized it has a 6-deep stack. And so they changed their password to 6 nonsense things and then back to the original one. To force the memory off the back of the stack in order to not have to change their password. So NIST said this guideline was suggested because passwords should be changed when a user wants to change them or if there's an indication of breach, not just because some amount of time has passed. And a guy named Mike Wilson, who's a founder of Password Ping, said, there have been multiple studies that have shown requiring frequent password changes to actually be counterproductive to good password security. Yeah, surprise. So anyway, the good news is, remember the old slogan back in the mainframe days of IBM? Nobody ever got fired for choosing IBM.
Yeah.
Even though they were like, they like had lost their edge. They were no longer like the best. Other non-IBM solutions were arguably less expensive, higher performance, more reliable, better service contracts. I mean, like they were like better, but it was like, ooh, crap, you know, what if I'm wrong? Well, nobody ever got fired for choosing IBM. Well, similarly, the NIST guidelines that were saying, yo, yes, you should change your passwords periodically. Well, IT departments probably had no choice but to follow the guidelines because then they couldn't get fired.
Right.
It's like nobody ever got fired for not doing
well. It's one less reason to fire you anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So everybody listening, if your company is saying you must change your passwords, in the show notes, I have the link to the entire document. In fact, that document is incredible. Actually, it was just published today, by the way, Tuesday, May 16th. It just came out.
Hallelujah.
And I don't know. I mean, I got a tiny little scroll thumb here. I don't know how many equivalent pages it is. It goes on and on and on and on. Anyway, it'll be the topic of a future podcast because there's a ton of stuff about authentication in there that I think will make some interesting material for our listeners.
Good, good, good.
They also say drop the algorithmic complexity, song and dance. No more arbitrary password complexity requirements needing mixtures of uppercase letters, symbols, and numbers, NIST wrote. If a user wants a password that is just emojis, they should be – God, I wonder how this happened at NIST. They must have just had a
– They read some papers, I guess.
Yeah.
Somebody got in there.
Wow, just emojis. They should be allowed. They said it's important to note the storage requirements. And, of course, as we know, salting, hashing, and macking such that if a password file is obtained by an adversary, an offline attack is very difficult to compromise.
We also know that it's better to have a variety in your password.
Well, it's definitely.
But you don't want to tell the hacker what the limitations are. Right?
Correct. It's yeah. What you always want is entropy. Entropy is the key. So however you obtain entropy, that's what you want.
Right.
And so, for example, Mike here, again, from Password Ping said, like frequent password changes, it's been shown repeatedly that these types of restrictions, that is on password complexity, often result in worse passwords.
Yeah.
So
that's
let
the other
people
reason. Yeah.
Do what they want, but enforce. Enforce.
Right.
And again, I have a sort of a nice compromise in Squirrel. I built a on-the-fly complexity evaluator, but it doesn't work by enforcing any specific guidelines. Users can do anything they want. It's just that the better their passwords are, the shorter it can be, and rank a higher level of complexity.
Clever.
So that's built in there too.
Boy.
I figured while I was at it. And then finally.
Now NIST compliant.
Oh, goody.
Squirrel, now NIST compliant.
And you are never required to change your password. They said require screening of new passwords against lists of commonly used or
idea.
Compromised passwords.
No more monkeys.
As it's right here in the show notes. It says, no more monkeys.
I wasn't reading that. That came out of my head, straight out of my head.
And mine, because of course, we've had a lot of fun with that. NIST notes that dictionary words, usernames, repetitive or sequential patterns all should be rejected. One of the best ways to ratchet up the strength of users' passwords is to screen them against lists of dictionary passwords or known compromised passwords. And, of course, monkeys used to be number 6. It's fallen down to, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, unfortunately. Anyway, we will come back to these guidelines in the future because, this document is full of goodies. Justin Garrison, shot me a note saying, quick correction on last week's Security Now 611 with respect to AMT over Wi-Fi. AMT can be set up with Intel Wi-Fi chips, but it does require additional settings to be enabled. Paraphrasing, if you have a laptop that supports AMT, where AMT has been provisioned, if AMT has had its optional wireless support also turned on, and if you're running Windows, then connecting your laptop to a public wireless network means that AMT is accessible to anyone else on that network. That is your AMT in your machine. The null authentication bypass vulnerability is present. So if that machine has not received a firmware update, anyone will be able to access the AMT system within that machine using the null authentication bypass. If you're a corporate IT department and if you have AMT enabled over Wi-Fi, turn it off now. And I've got a link for additional information in our show notes. And Leo, we have reached our lighter side moment.
Ah.
A two minute and 40 second brilliantly conceived and assembled spoof on the Amazon Echo, which appeared on last Saturday night's SNL, Saturday Night Live. If you Google Saturday Night Live, or I guess you can just Google Amazon Echo Silver.
That'll do it.
our listeners can find it. But I wanted to play the audio and show it to our podcast video listeners, just because it's a bit of really brilliant fun.
And what's really nice about this one is it works really well in audio as well as video. And I have but one word to say, which is Alessandra. Listen.
The new Amazon has everyone asking Alexa for help.
Alexa, what time is it? What the hell is wrong with this blasted thing? Amanda!
But the latest technology isn't always easy to use for people of a certain age.
These kids done bought me a busted machine again. Odessa!
That's why Amazon partnered with AARP to present the new Amazon Echo Silver, the only smart speaker device designed specifically to be used by the greatest generation. It's super loud and responds to any name even remotely close to its Alexa, so they can find out the weather.
Allegra, what is the weather outside?
It is 74 degrees and sunny.
Huh?
It is 74 degrees and sunny.
Where?
Outside.
What about it?
The temperature outside is 74 degrees and sunny.
I don't know about that.
The latest in sports.
Clarissa, how many did old Satchel strike out last night?
Satchel Paige died in 1982.
How many did he get?
Satchel Paige is dead.
He what now?
Died.
Who did?
Satchel Paige.
Oh. I don't know about that.
Even local news and pop culture.
Anita, what them boys up to across the street?
They are just playing.
They what now?
They are just playing.
You say they just playing now?
Yes, they are just playing.
I don't know about that.
Pair it to smart devices like your thermostat.
Alessandra, turn the heat up.
The room is already 100 degrees.
Are you trying to kill me, Alizé?
The new Amazon Echo Silver plays all the music they loved when they were young.
Angela, play black jazz.
Playing, jazz.
It also has a quick scan feature to help them find things.
Emilia, where did I put the phone?
The phone is in your right hand.
And it has an feature for long, rambling stories.
So then I gave him $5, and he said I only gave him $1.
Uh-huh.
I said, I know I gave you a $5.
Uh-huh.
Because I only had a $5 and a $1 on me.
Uh-huh.
And this is the $1 right here.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, you tell me who's crazy.
Amazon Echo Silver. Get yours today.
I said get yours today.
To order Amazon Echo Silver, send a check or money order to Amazon.com right now.
So funny. I've played it now several times. And it doesn't get any less funny. It's still amazing.
It's just, the acting is great. The various performances and, just well conceived.
Yeah. Very, very nice.
A couple weeks ago, Leo, a caller to your weekend show was asking you about adding smartphone connectivity to an older auto.
Right.
It may not surprise you to know that I have a solution. It turns out
you have an older auto as well.
I do.
Yeah.
And I now have a hands-free speakerphone on my phone and a USB that can play a thumb drive directly in the audio system without the need to use the cigarette lighter FM transmitter kludge. It's a little more expensive, but this is an amazing company. It's called Grom Audio, GROMAUDIO, GromAudio.com. They have a range of different retrofits for a huge range of older autos. So I just wanted to share that both with you for the future and also with our listeners who may be wanting to look at increasing their auto, an older auto's connectivity without exposing it to, you know, more dangers from the internet and so forth.
How does it connect to the automotives?
All of the in-dash entertainment systems have a big monster plug on the back for supporting CD changers and other add-ons.
Right, you have to get under the dash to do it.
So installing it does take some time. A buddy of mine has an 05 Infiniti, and you know, he was complaining that when he rents cars for work, they have all these new features, but you know, his 12-year-old Infiniti doesn't. Anyway, Mark took his entire center console apart one weekend, and after buying one of these, installed it, and now he's got, you know, he's got tunes playing from his I think he has it attached. He used the older iPod connector because that's the iPod that he had, and so he's got his iPod playing in his 2005 Infiniti. So
very nice.
Anyway, GROMAUDIO.com for anybody who's interested. Jonathan Bennett sent me a note saying, "Spinrite owner and longtime listener here. My son just introduced me to a puzzle game I thought you might like for iOS and Android, Square Dance. I saw this as I was catching up in my Twitter feed to prepare the show, so I've not looked at it, but I've never seen, anything rated so highly. It's like got almost 100% 5 stars. Apparently, it's great. So I wanted to thank Jonathan. I can't vouch for it yet, but I will give our listeners an update next week." And then he finished saying, "I have found the Frontier Saga audiobooks available through my library. Thankfully, each book is short, so I can fit in Security Now between books, and I don't have to fall too far behind. You were right," he wrote. "The action has been nonstop so far. I'm not quite done with the third book, but wow. Thank you for all you and Leo do." So, Jonathan, thanks for the pointer to Square Dance on iOS and Android. It looks great. It looks apparently really cool. So say the reviewers, the reviews that I read. And finally, Barrett Bain, who is a longtime listener, wrote, "I used my personal copy of Spinrite at level 2, as he should, on my work laptop with an SSD, thus level 2, because you only need to undo a read scan, to confirm that the drive was in fact dying. The early warning allowed me to pull all my backups together and prevent any loss of data. Thanks to listening to SN," "thanks to listening to SN since day one from my iPod, I have a better understanding than most of the level 1 techs here. So glad for how far pod," he says, "netcasts have come, and I appreciate all the work you and Leo put into the show. I'm looking forward to 6.1, 6.2, and 7. He's talking about future Spinrite releases, when we will see performance improvements and we'll be able to run it on a Mac. Please feel free to share my story / testimonial on Security Now and use my name. Thank you, Garrett Jackson, Wisconsin." Garrett, thanks for sharing it as well and helping me remind our listeners about Spinrite.
All right, I'm getting excited. Or I want to cry. I'm not sure which, but we'll do, we'll do that in just a second. But first, I want to talk about a sponsor I think you all know about a little bit. We've talked about many times before. In fact, they kind of got their start right here on Twit. And in fact, in two ways, of course, on the advertising side. But they were also so inspired by what we were doing here. They said, this is how we ought to do what we do. They were IT trainers. They were teaching people how to get their IT certs and all of that stuff. And they said, you know, it's one thing, you know, to do the classroom and everything, but wouldn't it be cool if we could have a set like the old screensaver set and we could have a chat room going on and people could participate live and they could watch on demand and they build IT Pro TV. And now it's huge and bigger and better than anything I ever did. But that's okay. I like it. I like it when they're successful. I'm actually really proud of Tim and Don. They've done a great job. And man, have they made something. Now they've moved to new studios. We were there at the opening a few months ago in Gainesville, Florida. Five studios offering 2,000 hours, more than 2,000 hours of content. And they're doing 125 hours of content streaming live every week. Sometimes two or three studios online all at the same time. It's pretty amazing, really. Courses in every subject you'd want to learn. Somebody emailed us. In fact, I'm sending him back a note. He said, I'm you know, 50 years old, and I need a career change, and I'd like to get into forensics. You know, I'm into computers. I love computers. I'm pretty good at them. I'd like to get in forensics, but how would I start? And, of course, you know, I told him, well, they're a sponsor, but itpro.tv/security. Now, that's how you start. They've got a great set of courses on forensics, and, of course, there's a forensics cert you can learn, which will make it a lot easier, frankly, to get that first job. They've got the EC Council's Certified Ethical Hacking Cert. That's an amazing one. That's 33 hours covering concepts and tools related to exploiting systems, networks, devices, and operating platforms. If you love this show, you're going to love the CEH. And their instructors are not only smart, they're fun, they're engaging. The ISC Squared Systems Security Certified Practitioner, Certified Information Systems Security Professional, Certified Cloud Security Professional. Microsoft certs, of course, all of them, including the MTA, the MCSA, the MCSE even. Now, if you don't have a Windows server, well, don't worry. Don't worry. They've got virtual servers that can run in any browser. You could set it all up, configure it, make mistakes, throw it away at the end. It's great. Of course, a complete set of directory skills in every area from Azure to Amazon Web Services to Cisco firewalls to cryptography. The Cyber Patriot Program, which is a free program for national youth cyber education, is really great. And they have a nice set of courses there, 11 hours. Email encryption, you need to learn that. 44 minutes later, you know everything there is to know. I can go on and on. What I'd like you to do is try it out. You could stream courses live and on demand worldwide. Go from their website to your Chromecast, to your Roku, to your Amazon Fire TV, to your Apple TV, to your PC. They've got courses coming up for Apple folks, Apple Certified Support Professional, CompTIA's Security Plus. That's a very good cert if you want to get in that business. ITIL Planning, Protection, and Optimization. They have business process courses, too. It's really cool. Every course, just like this show, has a transcript to follow. You can follow from start to finish or search the transcript and jump right to that part of the video you need to practice, you need to learn. New enterprise clients include L.L. Bean, Meridian Health Services, Tech Data, Avnet, Phillips 66, Disney ABC Television Group. And that list was formed before WannaCry, WannaCrypt. I think they're going to get a few signups on a Monday and Tuesday. There are going to be some people saying, we better learn this stuff now. You've got to check it out. They have a career concierge service, which will help you create and follow a learning and certification program. You can call them and say, what should I do? In fact, that's exactly what we told that fella. We said, call them, and they'll tell you what you need to do. Now, they have created a new standard membership level, which gives you access to all the live and on-demand content, but that's it. And this is affordable, It's great for review. It's great to just kind of have going on in the background if that's how you want to watch it. I know a lot of people do. That's a good deal. But I got to tell you about the premium annual membership. That includes the video content, of course, but also the virtual labs I mentioned. They have great Q&A forums. It's like a study group. You can join anytime, anywhere. And you get the Transcend practice exams, which is a great deal, too. The Transcender exams are $109 value and lets you practice the test before you take the test. So if you're working towards a cert, now that's why they've got these new counselors, because they have a lot of different offerings, and you really have to figure out what it is your goal is, what you're trying to achieve. I have to say, though, we've put a pretty good deal together for you. Normally, the annual premium membership is $85.70 a month. That's about $857 a year. They give you 2 months free when you subscribe for a year. But I think we have something a little bit better to offer you. If you go to itpro.tv/securitynow, itpro.tv/securitynow, and use the code SN30, you will get a 7-day trial free. Plus, if you sign up, 30% off a monthly membership forever for the lifetime of your active subscription. And that brings it down to a very affordable price. And boy, look at all the stuff you get. I want you to check it out right now. Just go to, and by the way, you can get that discount on the standard membership as well. Go to itpro.tv/securitynow. Tim Broom, Dom Pezet, they are great guys. They will help you. Their concierge service will help you. Find out what you need to know. itpro.tv/securitynow. Start a great new career, or just, you know, keep up on the career you've chosen. But don't forget that offer code, SN30. Love these guys, and I'm very proud of what they've done and what we've helped them do, and they're the first to say it. All right. I think it's time to talk about WannaCrypt.
Almost. What do you call it? We got a little closing the loop feedback.
Oh, good.
To do.
Okay.
Someone whose Twitter handle is VegaSka, S-K-A, said he asked an interesting question, something that I don't think we've ever talked about, regarding load balancing. He said, Google's DNS resolves to 12 IPs, but Google.com resolves one IP. How does this work? This is an interesting bit of incredible forethought by the original designers of DNS. The idea is that any domain can have, that is, any DNS server can present more than one IP for a given domain name. So, you know, Microsoft.com, I think, is the same way. Google.com, if you actually use a tool like NSLookup or Dig, you'll see that you get back a block of IPs. Every DNS server which answers a DNS query that has a block of IPs, whether it's the authoritative original server or a caching server somewhere out on the internet that previously asked and the answer has not yet expired, rotates the list of IPs every time it is asked for the IP list for a given domain. So there's automatic built-in round-robin load balancing built into DNS queries. The beauty of that result is that typical users or consumers of the IP list from a DNS query start with the first one, and they go with it if they get a connection there. But if no machine is there, then they go to the second one and the third one and so forth. So just by simply allowing a list of IPs, and by formally setting the practice of rotating that list circularly, you get the best of all worlds. You get that the first one in the list is always rotating among all the people who ask, so thus the balancing of the load among all the IPs, and you get the fault tolerance of, well, if the first one in the list doesn't answer for whatever reason, you go to the next one. So, neat question. And I just thought it was something we've never talked about before. Believe it or not, there's still a few things like that. Someone who is a frequent Twitter participant, Glassair Pilot, asked, why would engineers spend the money for Android mics that have a frequency response into the ultrasonic? And that's something we hadn't touched on when we were talking about the prevalence of ultrasonic monitoring and spying and tracking. And the answer is that in this context, ultrasonic doesn't mean like medical ultrasound in the super high kilohertz or even low megahertz range. It only means non-audible, which is to say anything above 20 hertz. And the fact is, many very small microphones have a natural frequency response well above 20 kilohertz, maybe 25, maybe even, 26, 27, 29. So it's not that they're more expensive or that there was any intention behind the fact that the microphones that are used in smartphones just happen to extend beyond our hearing range. It's just that mechanically they do. And so people realized, oh, look, we can, well, like the EKG machine that you really like, Leo, the cute little portable EKG.
Cardia, yeah.
Yeah. That uses a frequency modulated ultrasound. But again, in this context, I mean, ultrasound does have a formal definition. Well, the word means, supersonic, above sonic. And maybe that would be a better term, to instead of saying ultrasonic, to say supersonic, meaning just, above our hearing range. And then Chris Ebert, sort of on the same lines, asked, he says, it seems that it should be possible for mobile OSs to filter ultrasonic frequencies from the microphone before providing it in the API. And I agree. I think it's just something that they don't do. Maybe they will. It's kind of handy. And the bad news is if they did, then the little cute little frequency modulated supersonic EKG machine would stop to work, as would maybe there are legitimate purposes for it. So, but maybe the user should have the choice of like turning on a supersonic filter on their microphone for that purpose. Or maybe it'll just be added in the future. And Michael Cunningham, another frequent Twitterer, brought a Ubiquiti router firmware update to my attention. We've been previously talking about the non-edge router updates that Ubiquiti released for all of their Air OS machines that had some concerns. This one does apply to our cute little Edge Router X boxes. Oh, and by the way, Elaine got one last week. So Elaine is following along. Not only does she look up all the words and make sure everything is spelled correct, but she's following along with some of the security advice and now has herself a little Ubiquiti Edge Router X. And she wrote to me, said, it is adorable, just like you said. Anyway, they fixed that UDP problem we talked about a few weeks back, which is the vulnerability of the message peak flag, where software might look at the UDP packet's contents without removing it. And the code for checking the checksum, the unsafe second checksum was what the problem was called. That was where the problem was. So on April 28th, Ubiquiti released version 1.9.11 for the wired Ubiquiti Edge Router family. There's the X, the non-X, and several others. So if you are an owner of those, the ones we've been talking about and really like, you might want to check with Ubiquiti for a firmware update. You want version 1.9.11 or maybe later. They don't do them very often, so I mean, imagine that's the one that's there now. Andrew Douglas asked, how do TOTP apps work? He says, I use them, but have no idea how those six magic numbers work. Any chance you could dig in a little on Security Now? And I'll just say quickly that it's very cool. Basically, it is a cryptographically driven time sequence. And the security requirement is that the sequence be unpredictable and that at any given instant there be no way for a bad guy to predict what the six digits will be based on any knowledge of the previous six digits. So we accomplish that by using what's known as a keyed HMAC. Well, that's sort of redundant. A keyed MAC, a message authentication code, which is an HMAC. An HMAC, a hashed MAC, is a security, a well-known security primitive, which uses a hash several times in order to mix a secret key into the hashing process. So we feed the time of day into this keyed hash where the key is a secret, and out comes, depending upon the size of the hash, a binary blob from which six digits are extracted, and that's your token. And every 30 seconds, the time is updated in order, and then that is rehashed with the same secret in order to get a different six digits. So it's as simple as that. And finally, we actually heard from the Department of Defense, who weighed in on the exploding missile logic. We talked about how it really wasn't necessary to do garbage collection and worry about memory leaks if you were writing the flight control software for a missile, because as long as the memory would not become exhausted within the expected maximum flight time of the missile, garbage, the unreleased memory leak was not going to be a long-term problem. This person wrote, I work with the DOD missile RAM issue. It's likely far, far cheaper to double the hardware, meaning the RAM, rather than pay a contractor to fix the memory leak. Contract ending, other important bugs to fix, etc. After all, what's the hardware cost per missile? Likely very small. How many missiles? Likely not that many. So we've heard from our listeners about various topics from last week. WannaCry, or makes you want to cry. So what do you get when you combine an extremely old and powerful, always on and present, networked remote code exploit requiring no user interaction with money-making, file-encrypting malware, the inherent vulnerability of social engineering phishing attacks, and then toss in a capable backdoor while you're at it? Well, it makes you want to cry. This, you know, global, potent and capable crypto malware payload, which leverages the NSA's leaked, ubiquitously present, and well-weaponized external blue Windows SMB vulnerability for propagation, is what we got. Now, there was a lot of disagreement about the name for this thing. The reason is it never formally declared its own name. I went with WannaCrypt, although I added a second N because it seems a little more grammatically correct. It's been called WCry, WannaCryptor, WannaCry, Wanna Decryptor, etc. For me, what was definitive was the source code refers to itself in several places as WannaCry. And more importantly, the encrypted file header, that is the new header added to every file that it encrypts, the first 8 characters are WANACRY exclamation point. So WannaCry. I think that is probably the correct name for this. And people were a little confused because Wanna Decryptor is the name that's also present, but that's, of course, the decrypting side, the part where you're no longer crying, except maybe over the Bitcoins that you just had to spend. But, you know, you're in the process, hopefully, of getting your files back. Although, you know, I watched the whoever it was, junior cyber somebody, come out before yesterday's press briefing with Sean Spicer. And what he said seemed to have about as much misfact as it did correct fact. So I don't know what to believe from what he said. He said that there had been no evidence of anyone decrypting their files after receiving payment. He's the only place I ever heard that said. So I would, you know, as I would always look for multiple sources of confirmation, I assume that people who pay get their files back. But his statement, which was the official U.S. position statement, threw that into question for me. So I don't know one way or the other. We do know that today there have been at least 5 identified variants, and I've seen infection estimates fall between 200,000 and 300,000. Yesterday, the same person said 300,000, and there is the site which was created by the attacker who created the inadvertent kill switch we'll talk about in a second. And I glanced at it this morning, and it was now above 300,000. I don't remember how far above, but it was north of 300,000. So assuming that he's doing IP, single counting and not multiply counting IPs, he had set up a web server at this bizarre domain, and the code in the WannaCry infection checks that site for a connection. If it obtains a connection, just anybody answering TCP, it then no longer proceeds. So that does allow him not only to neuter the infection, but simultaneously track a count of how many infections are present. Earlier, I read that it was only looking, it was performing a DNS lookup, and that he simply looked up the DN, that the malware performed a DNS query. If it got a resolution to DNS, it didn't infect. However, I subsequently saw the source code, and the source code actually performs a connection with an integral lookup as part of it. So you do have to have something there answering a TCP connection, not even a web server, just a hello, yes, here's a TCP handshake, and then this thing shuts down. So this is a worm by the classic definition of a worm, meaning something that is self-propagating with no user input, which itself, from a single instance, has the potential of taking over a large number of other systems, meaning that it is, the infection itself is also a scanner which successfully scans for other machines to infect. It so it meets the definition. When it installs itself, it looks at the local block of IPs where it is, and immediately scans the /24 subnet, that is the 256 IPs in its own network neighborhood, for anything else that is any other machines to infect. So it is a virulent intranet infector. And in fact, it is believed that's how things like the UK's NSS and NHS network, and even FedEx here in the US, and also the Telefonica telephone ISP in Spain got themselves massively infected was that somehow a single point of entry was obtained, and then these organizations had huge Windows infrastructures with, it should be noted, unupdated Windows machines, that is, not since March, or maybe unupdatable Windows machines that we'll talk about in a second. So there's still some question among the security community whether there was also a phishing campaign to get this into organizations. That Spain's Telefonica believed that there was a PDF file containing a .hta, an HTML application exploit, that someone, you know, a phishing email clicked a link, and in this case, thanks to Eternal Blue, it didn't just compromise that person's machine, but it got in and then it went crazy within the intranet. So, you know, and this follows what we talked about when we were talking about Eternal Blue originally, was, you know, because it's a Windows SMB exploit, I rhetorically asked, how can this, be a danger on the internet? Well, it turns out there are tens of thousands, as we later learned, tens of thousands of apparent SMB 445 ports exposed publicly. So, and all it takes is one. It takes one machine somewhere in an organization that has that exposed one way or the other for the other WannaCry worms to find it. Because not only when WannaCry sets up, does it start looking on its own intranet, it also launches 128 public internet scanning worms to scan all of the public internet. It uses the high-quality cryptographic entropy source built into Windows, if available. Otherwise, it falls back to a pseudo-random number generator that's still, you know, it's just picking IPs, 32 bits at random, and tries to make a port 445 connection. So that's what happened, was that once this thing started, it found all the other publicly available SMB ports on the internet. And with each one that it found, it infected it. And that one became a scanner in pure Code Red NIMDA MS Blast style, that, you know, the kinds of attacks on a global scale the world hasn't been subject to for years. So why was the UK's NHS hit so hard? By some estimates, approximately 90% of the NHS in UK has remained on Windows XP and did pay Microsoft hugely. I saw a number, £5.5 million quoted. I think it was pounds and not euros, to extend support for an additional year past XP's patch death. And I think I remember us reporting that at the time, that they decided to just buy another year of support because they wanted it. But
well, they're regretting, you know, that now.
That was in 2014.
Because Microsoft didn't offer a patch even if they bought support, did they? I mean,
correct. That only gave them 1 year of extended of support after the end of the extended support. So that brought them up short.
You can't. I have to say, though, and I've talked to our IT guy Russell about this. He's got a few hospitals. They're really, every time you do an upgrade, they have to recertify the stuff, and it's not. There are quite a few businesses for whom moving to the newest versions is expensive and not a great idea. So,
which is the perfect segue to the next topic. I have it here in bold. Is blaming the victim here justified?
Right. It's tempting.
I said it's easy to do, but I think it's more subtle than that in the real world. In today's environment, everyone should accept all available updates. That's clear. But notice the way I deliberately phrased that. All available updates should be accepted. What about when updates are no longer being made available? What about Win XP embedded in a decade-old MRI scanner, or which, you know, which is working fine otherwise, or a passenger ticketing kiosk, or a banking ATM machine. In many cases, their manufacturer would love to profitably sell an updated system. But what if the one you have is already working just fine? Or if there isn't budget available for wholesale replacing 90% of a massive IT infrastructure? Or what if the company who created the devices 10 years ago is long since gone? And as you say, Leo, the need for compliance to have certification of any changes. You know, they're in the real world, there are real reasons for a sane IT policy of, okay, we're going to attempt to retain security oversight and control to the best of our ability. And in this case, that failed.
It's why hospitals get bit disproportionately by these attacks.
Yes. I mentioned this thing having a weird kill switch. A security researcher looking through the code found this bizarre domain.
No, you're not going to read it.
No, I'm not. I'll just give people a sense for it.
I can zoom in on it.
IUQERFSODP9IFJAPO and so forth. That's about
it. Looks like a Gaelic town is what it looks like.
Yeah, it's just not. You know, clearly a big, long piece of gibberish, .com. The code uses an older Windows Connect Windows TCP connection function to attempt to make a TCP connection. If it succeeds, for whatever reason, it shuts down. So what this means is if there is a server there, do not infect. So it was clearly a kill switch, or maybe he put it in and he was going to write some other code, but then forgot to. And so the default of making a connection just said, oh, instead of doing what I was going to do, do nothing. Who knows what's behind it? But what was discovered was the hacker registered the domain, set up a server to monitor the infection, and discovered that not only did it monitor it, it shut it down. So it stopped infecting. The problem is that it was... Well, first of all the variants that have subsequently appeared don't have that. And there's even a variant where that domain and that feature has been hex edited out of the binary.
Now, so I have a theory about all this.
Okay.
And do you want to hear? Now, it starts with this morning's report from NPR that North Korea might be involved in this. And the reason some security researchers think so is there's a lot of commonality in the code base with the Lazarus attackers, the Lazarus group, who did, of course, Sony. Some of the code is very similar. So now, of course, code can be copied. But when I first saw this, and I was wondering what you thought, the fact that it was translated into like 15 different languages.
It was very language complete.
And it was also very helpful. It had links to what Bitcoin is and where to buy Bitcoin. The fact that they raised so little money but put so much effort into it. And then this kill switch kind of made me think governmental operation. And so the theory, and of course it's hard to confirm because you can't, but the theory is perhaps this was not an attempt to raise money, but to cause global disruption or some other things. By the way, it didn't hit the U.S. hardly at all. Mostly hit Russia and Asia before it got shut down.
I would argue, though, that's as a consequence of the install base.
Yes,
you know, you can run pirated Windows XP
and something
very
like this
easily.
Doesn't get geographically contained very easily. I understand that as well.
Right.
There's no conclusive evidence at all, but it isn't inconsistent with a hacker that might have motives other than mere financial gain.
Yeah. To that, I just shrug.
What are you going to say, right?
Yeah, well, I just, you know, I don't have an opinion on that, but yeah, it's certainly possible. I did find a couple interesting little bit of technical details. My favorite one was to look a little more closely at what the actual Eternal Blue exploit was. And it turns out, get a load of this, because we've talked about these sorts of problems. There is in this SMB code that's been around forever in Windows is a very subtle buffer overflow in a memory move operation. The size of the move is calculated, but the calculation has a type error in the math. A D word, that is a 32-bit double word, is subtracted into a word. So again, a very subtle error. It's not clear to me whether someone would have looked at the source code and spotted that. The fact that it's from the fuzz bunch makes me think that it was some sophisticated fuzzing, meaning that a whole bunch of crap was being thrown at the ports of a Windows machine, logging what was being thrown in case the junk that was being thrown at it caused it to crash. Because if so, then they would go in and forensically determine when exactly the crash occurred, what had been thrown at it that caused it, and then reverse engineer the exploit from there, which is, you know, the way a lot of these things have been found. So that's my guess. But I thought, oh, yep, here once again, a D word was subtracted and the result was a word. So that the point being that the subtraction was tried to be stored into a smaller container, a 16-bit value from a 32-bit subtraction, which then wouldn't fit, and you could get up to all kinds of mischief that way. And finally, Brad Smith, Microsoft's president and chief legal officer, weighs in. He has sort of a rambling post about social responsibility and so forth, and which takes no responsibility for this. The title of his posting was "The Need for Urgent Collective Action to Keep People Safe Online: Lessons from Last Week's Cyber Attack." And I snipped all of the preamble and conclude with him saying, "Finally, this attack provides yet another example of why the stockpiling of vulnerabilities by governments is such a problem. This is an emerging pattern in 2017, he writes. We've seen vulnerabilities stored by the CIA show up on WikiLeaks, and now this vulnerability stolen from the NSA. Notice he didn't say, I mean, there's no punches pulled here. It's like, you know, maybe or believed to be or anything. He just says, now this vulnerability stolen from the NSA has affected customers around the world. Repeatedly, exploits in the hands of governments have leaked into the public domain and caused widespread damage. An equivalent scenario with conventional weapons would be the U.S. military having some of its Tomahawk missiles stolen. And this most recent attack represents a completely unintended but disconcerting link between the two most serious forms of cybersecurity threats in the world today: nation-state action and organized criminal action. Finally, the governments, he writes, of the world should treat this attack as a wake-up call. They need to take a different approach and adhere in cyberspace to the same rules applied to weapons in the physical world. We need the problem with that is attribution, of course. He says, we need governments to consider the damage to civilians that comes from hoarding these vulnerabilities and the use of these exploits. This is one reason we called in February for a new, quote, digital Geneva Convention, unquote, to govern these issues, including a new requirement for governments to report vulnerabilities to vendors. Yes, Microsoft would like that, rather than stockpile, sell, or exploit them. And it's why, or lose them. And it's why we've pledged our support for defending every customer everywhere in the face of cyber attacks, regardless of their nationality and regardless of the OS's age. This weekend, whether it's in London, New York, Moscow, Delhi, Sao Paulo, or Beijing, we're putting this principle into action and working with customers around the world.
Well, he's right. Of course, it would be great if they didn't do it, but they never won't do it because – and if governments don't, well, the bad guys will.
So
that's foolish optimism.
It is a conundrum. That, I mean, I get the NSA's plight. They, you know, they're wanting to use things they find for their own purposes, and if they they tell Microsoft, Microsoft will fix them. And unfortunately, the worse they are, worse in this context, the more valuable they are, because the more powerful they are. And the more they can leverage them, as they need. So, boy, as you said, Leo, it is the world we live in today.
I think they want a variety as opposed to power, because they're, in theory, not doing mass collection. They're targeting individuals. So a variety of exploits at work in a variety of situations would be more useful, but that's why they stockpile them.
Well, and remember, Eternal Blue was only one thing, but
we're going to see so much more of this.
Yes, the thing that made this worm a worm, that gave it its teeth, was the Eternal Blue component. We've had crypto malware for a long time, and it's a problem, and it's annoying, but it's not this. It was the.
Well, did it make this that much worse?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That was the worm. It was an SMB worm,
right.
And that's what made that's what brought down NHS in the UK.
Right.
It was the wormness of this, and the fact that it encrypted all the system's files. But this is to your point, Leo. For the NSA to have Eternal Blue doesn't mean the NSA has a worm. What they had was a powerful SMB exploit that could be used as a worm, as it was, but they could also use it for surgical intrusion, which is probably what they were using
much
it
more
for.
Likely, yeah.
Yes. And just one final note, Simon Zarafa, also a frequent contributor through Twitter, said, no WannaCry ransomware on Windows XP. So why did MS release the XP patches? And this follows from somebody, a security researcher, who noted that there were aspects of the code that they believed wouldn't function in XP. Well, clearly, the NHS got obliterated.
Apparently,
as a consequence
it worked okay.
of XP.
It worked well enough.
but I would also argue that with it now being with this SMB exploit having been developed into a worm that was this bad, Microsoft was forced to move.
Right.
And this, of course, is very reminiscent to the MS Blast worm, because Microsoft was adamant about ignoring my years of begging them and warning them about raw sockets in XP until the MS Blast worm used raw sockets in Windows to blast the crap out of Microsoft and scared them and forced them to remove raw sockets from XP, or to dramatically neuter them to the point where it could no longer be used for this purpose. So, you know, Microsoft doesn't listen to anybody unless they absolutely finally have no deniability and no other choice. And so, yes, they fixed this in XP also.
Yeah.
Yay. Yeah. I have an update.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think they're doing now one of the things you're critical of them that with the browser thing is they're trying to create with 10S a more secure operating system.
Well, I'm not critical of them
towards this goal, but what you see the downside is
they're creating a choice.
There'll be a kind of a homogenous system as a result. And
although I don't want to use Bing,
I know
I have an anti-Bing bias.
Yeah, Yeah, it's an interesting puzzle because I understand why Microsoft says, well, we can't turn off SMB1 on all our systems ever made because people rely on it, and that would hurt those hospitals just as much as this did.
Yep,
that's a very difficult thing. The only thing we know for sure is it's only going to get worse, a lot worse. In my
opinion. And rather than turning it off, they might as well patch it. I mean, now it's fixed.
Yeah. But they didn't know the flaw was there until the shadow brokers dumped the exploit from the Equation Group.
And then they immediately responded.
Yes,
they got it patched
2 months ago.
Yes.
Not everybody applied it. I don't know. And that's another thing they're doing. They're requiring people with Windows 10 to apply patches. You can only defer
for so long.
And they
didn't backpatch either. And now they have. But notice that they didn't, even though it was really, really, really bad. They didn't do it. Well,
you better believe
they had to.
They're going through those other shadow broker exploits, and they'll be back patching all of them. What did they do yesterday? There was a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Steve Gibson, he's the guy. Thank goodness we have him. He's the man in charge at GRC.com, Gibson Research Corporation. That's where SpinRite lives, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. You can get your copy there. You can also get your copy of this show there. And not only 64 kilobit audio, but nice transcripts that you can follow along as you listen or search and find the part that you're most interested in. A lot of people find it easier to understand, Steve, if they're reading at the same time and their brain gets it in two different ways. I would read, listen, and watch. Do it all. We do like you to check out the video. That's available at twit.tv/SN, as is the audio. You can also subscribe in your favorite podcast utility. Actually, that's the best way. Then you won't miss an episode. And I think this is like the 10-foot shelf in of technology. You want to get every episode in your collection so you can always go back and learn. Because a lot of this stuff is still the same. There's a lot of great stuff in these 600-some episodes. Steve, we'll be back here next Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. What do you think?
I'm ready for it, my friend.
I'll see you then on Security Now.
Thanks, Leo.
Security Now.